Hello, I'm Glenn Hauser, host of World of Radio. This is 0277, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0277. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, another visit from Nick Santora, the executive producer of CBS's Scorpion. He's also the author of a children's book called I Want an Alien for Christmas. Why write a children's book?
You know, I had always really wanted to make something that my kids could enjoy, from my television work, from Sopranos to Prison Break to Breakout King. Most of the stuff I've done and my novels, they're pretty darn violent and crazy at times, and my kids can't read that stuff. I always wanted to do something that they could enjoy.
Edward Myers from Ripley's Believe It or Not is on, talking about their latest book, Reality Shock.
About 1,000 stories, roughly 500 great photos. It's an oversized coffee table style book, you know, not necessarily meant to be read cover to cover, but one of those things that you put it down and open it up at any page and you're going to find something that's going to amaze you, and you'll end up reading a lot more than you thought you might.
Scott Baker, co-author of A Warmer Shade of Blue. Scott has written humorous books about life as a police officer, but this time he's changed gears and has shared some of the heartwarming stories of the men and women in blue.
People ask me all the time about the funny stories, but there's more important things. It's funny, you know, like the funny stories that happen are super subjective, so you could tell a story, someone could think like, oh, that's not funny, whatever. But, you know, everyone loves a good heartfelt, spiritual, feel-good story. I think that's why Chicken Soup for the Soul has done so well, but in a time like now, we really need it. You know, I think there's a total miscommunication between what people perceive between the community and the police.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0277, was Glenn Hauser, the host of World of Radio. And you can check out his website at worldofradio.com. Thank you very much, Glenn, for doing this edition of the Stuff File program Slate on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A woman and her pot-bellied pig were booted off a Washington, D.C.-bound plane after passengers complained the pig was disruptive and stinky. The pig, thought to be about 70 pounds, had been brought aboard the U.S. Airways plane at Bradley International Airport in Connecticut as an emotional support animal. Crew members determined the animal was too disruptive and asked the woman to leave with the pig before the flight departed. Some people aboard the plane thought the woman was carrying a large duffel bag over her shoulder, but it turns out it wasn't a duffel bag. We could smell it, and it was pig, and it was a pig on a leash. According to passenger Jonathan Skolnick, she tethered it to the armrest next to me and started to deal with her stuff, but the pig was walking back and forth. Wow. Well, this brings new meaning to the term, when pigs fly, doesn't it? But seriously, I hate to be cold-hearted, but if you need a pig to fly because it's a companion animal, then you shouldn't really be flying. May I suggest the train, Greyhound, a rental? Pick another method. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Retired car salesman Anthony Claessens and his wife couldn't afford $495 for a purebred Bichon Frise puppy from a pet store in Oceanside, California. So they financed the animal for 27 monthly payments of $95.99, or a total of $2,591.73.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the wagon-y tail.
Yeah. When the couple got home, Anthony read the paperwork and was shocked, shocked, I say, to find that he not only had not purchased the dog, but only leased it. And the contract noted that if you do not exercise your right to buy the pet at the end of the lease, you will return it to us at a place we identify. That's right. Even after all those payments, they still could not own the dog, but would have to pay $93.52 at the end of the lease, or $187.04 to buy the dog, plus official fees and taxes.
I do hope that doggy's for sale.
Oceanside puppy pet store owner David Salinas says 90% of his customers finance their pet purchases, and it is only a surprise to the customer if they do not read their contract. The Claysons canceled the lease, returned the dog, and got a new Bichon Frise puppy for free from their local animal shelter. Yes, so apparently it is possible to go from incredibly stupid to incredibly smart in one simple decision. Well, doggone. Federal prosecutors said a for-profit college in Florida hired exotic dancers to work as admissions representatives to attract young men to the school. The U.S. Attorney's Office and Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, who joined the whistleblowing lawsuit against Miami-based Fast Train College, said in a civil complaint at least one of the school's now closed seven campuses used strippers as admissions representatives. The college purposely hired attractive women and sometimes exotic dancers and encouraged them to dress provocatively while they recruited young men in neighborhoods to attend Fast Train, the complaint states. The whistleblower lawsuit was originally filed by Juan Pena, a former admissions employee, of course, at the Plantations campus and the Flagler campus. The school's campuses, or would that be Camp I? I don't know, were shut down in 2012 following a raid by the FBI. Alejandro Amor, chief executive officer for the company, was indicted in October on criminal charges of conspiracy and theft of government money. Federal authorities said the school received more than $35 million in Pell Grants and other federal financial aid between 2009 and 2012, and they allege the school obtained a large amount of grant money through fraudulent means, including falsifying high school diplomas for ineligible students. Wow. I'm guessing that this is a school that doesn't teach ethics classes, or for that matter, has a dress code. Yeah. Anyway, we have time for one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. 30-year-old Peter Davis boarded the E-Train subway in New York and saw a man drinking whiskey and wearing nothing but socks and sneakers. Nothing but socks and sneakers. Just as odd was the lack of concern the other passengers seemed to have. He was just really wasted, said Davis. People were shocked. I took a picture. Nobody else did anything. Davis posted a picture of the man on Instagram, where it went viral until administrators took the picture down, calling it inappropriate. Davis didn't report the man, though. If I had alerted police, then he may have gotten arrested, and I didn't want to be a snitch and send him to jail. Wow. You know, it may be a sign of the times that the only shocking part was that he took a picture. I mean, seriously, he didn't want to snitch on the guy? Hey, there's a naked drunk guy on the subway. How do you not call the police? And how would you like to sit on the same seat after the guy is done with it? You know, I'd call the cops myself and probably a hazmat team. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Writer and television producer Nick Santora is on the show with us once again. We've talked to him about his television series, such as the new CBS hit show called Scorpion, and we've also talked in the past about his writing of thriller novels such as 15 Digits. But this time around, we're going to talk to Nick about his new children's book called I Want an Alien for Christmas. Nick joins us on the line once again, right now, from California. Hi, Nick.
Hello, Peter.
So, while growing up, did you want an alien for Christmas?
Yeah. Well, you know what? My grandfather stowed away from Italy. I think he was my alien every Christmas.
With all that you're doing with the books and the television series, and that takes a lot of time and a lot of work, where did you find the time to write a children's book?
You know, I had always really wanted to make something that my kids could enjoy, as you know from my, you know, television work, from Sopranos to Prison Break to Breakout Kings. Most of the stuff I've done and my novels, which you've read, they're pretty darn violent and crazy at times, and my kids can't read that stuff. I always wanted to do something that they could enjoy, and I wrote this story. It's a chapter book. It's not a picture book, so my little one, I have to read it to her, but she loves it. But my 10-year-old has read it 4 or 5 times already. It's for my 5 or 6-year-old to 12 or 13-year-old. And I wrote something they can enjoy, and I'm really proud of it.
So tell us the story. Tell us what the story's about. I'm sure that the title says a lot, but what's the story behind the story?
Well, basically, in a nutshell, a lot of people don't realize that on December 17th, Santa Claus does a test run a week before Christmas Eve with his head elf, Elvis. And they check weather patterns and track their route for Christmas Eve and make sure everything's okay. But when he zips behind a cloud cluster, he smashes into a little star hopper, which is the version of like an alien jet ski. And so they get into an accident. And Santa and Elvis tumble into the star hopper, and our 10-year-old alien Gug flips in the air and lands in the sleigh. The reindeer get spooked and try to run away from the alien. But reindeers are stupid. They don't realize that they are harnessed into the sleigh. They wind up crashing in a small town of Millbrook Falls, New Hampshire, and our heroes, these three kids, Theo, Olivia, and Sophie Bartlett, soon find the sleigh and the alien, Gug, and surmise we have 1 week to get the alien back home, Santa back here, and save Christmas. And they have to do all of this while an official from NORAD is chasing Santa, because he has a grudge against Santa because he didn't get what he wanted when he was 10 years old. And there's a bad shopping mall Santa that wants to catch the alien Gug and return him or bring him into the National Enquirer for a $1 million reward. And there's a school bully that gets in the mix. And it's this real sci-fi, fun, comedic adventure that has actually recently been optioned for an animated film. So, hopefully people will buy it, read it at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, get their kids into the world, and then in a few years they can take them to see the movie.
Now, it's interesting because I was just about to ask that question obviously it's a little late for this holiday season to see it on the screen, but I thought this would make a great either a theatrical film or a television special. You say it's been optioned already?
Yes, it has been optioned, and, that's just the first of 7,000 steps to actually get it to the big screen, but I'm hoping it will happen. I'll be involved not only writing a screenplay, but I'm going to be a producer on it as well, so I'll have a little bit more say. Normally in the feature world, the writer has zero say, which is the exact opposite of television, where the writer's in charge of everything. So hopefully I'll have a little bit more creative say on this one, and we'll move forward and see what happens. And one thing that'll help it is as if all of your listeners go out and support this book, it increases the chances of it getting on film. So, BarnesandNoble.com. And Amazon says it's temporarily out of stock, but I ordered 70 for a Girl Scout troop, and they just came in. So I'm trying to get them to remove that, but it's working. You'll get your books.
Now, the idea of it being on film, was this something that was always your intention all along, or was this a happy byproduct of writing the book?
Well, I'd love to say it was a happy byproduct, but it really was pretty much a calculated move, Peter. It's very hard to get movies made today. Unless there's an alien or a monster or a superhero, or if it's based on a comic book or a sequel or a prequel, original material just isn't getting made, or very rarely getting made, other than the specialty film market. So I knew that if I wanted to tell this story visually, I'd have to first put it on paper. And it's not a small book. It's a chapter book. It's 124 pages. Not as long as my crime novels, obviously, which are over 300, but it was a real endeavor. But the goal of that endeavor was to write a book that was hopefully good enough, that people enjoyed enough, that parents loved and kids loved, that it would get support and then become a film.
They say that writing is writing. You've written novels, you've written television series, but is writing a children's book like using a different writing muscle? Is it a different thing to do for you than the work that, that we all know you for?
Yeah, I had to put a lot less prison shankings in this one. No, yeah, it was. I use a different muscle. You absolutely have to gear it towards that sense of wonderment and that sense of first-time excitement. I forget sometimes that things that are completely mundane to me are so cool to my children. And I love seeing that sense of pure wonderment in them. They'll go to my parents' house and find in the basement like an old rotary phone, like thrown in a box in my parents' basement, and they'll play with it for an hour because they think it's the coolest thing in the world. And I'll say, kids, it's a stupid rotary phone. And I have to realize, don't be so jaded. It's cool to them. They've never seen one before. I felt that way while writing this book, that I had to tap into that sense of everything for the first time. And it was fun doing that because so many of the characters that I write are streetwise and a little jaded, and they know everything. And it was fun to bring a little bit of innocence into my writing.
Now, when you were writing this book, did you test drive it along the way with either your kids or any other kids, or did you just not do that until the finished product?
No, I actually did test drive it. Yeah, that's a good prediction by you. I would read chapters to my kids and my nieces as I went along. And I'd go chapter by chapter. I'd write a new chapter. I'd write, you know, maybe five or six new chapters and get them all together one night after if my nieces were over my house for dinner or something. And I'd say, hey, would you guys mind? And it got to the point where they'd come over the house one day and say, do you have any more pages of Alien for Christmas? And they got as pushy as a publisher. You know, they wanted me turning out pages. They wanted to hear what was going to happen next. And I would see, just by the way they reacted, they're too young and frankly too sweet and polite to say, I don't like that, that stinks. But I could tell by their reaction when things really hit. Kids can't fake sincere belly laughs. So when these kids were laughing out loud and you could see it in their face, I knew that that chapter was working. And if I'd see them looking over my shoulder and making funny faces in the mirror reflection behind me, I could tell they were getting bored. And so I had to work on that stuff a little bit more.
So has writing I Want an Alien for Christmas made you want to do more children's writing?
I really enjoy, there are some people out there that write incredible stuff for kids. There's a series of books called the Warrior series, which is, I think there's like 30-something of these books. And it's about feral cats and various tribes, like six or seven tribes of feral cats. I mean, this stuff is epic. It's so amazing. And there's Brandon Sanderson, who writes these incredible books. And they're chapter books for kids, but I read them with my daughter, and they blow me away. I don't know if I have that kind of talent, to be completely honest. The stuff that they do to write these incredible epic series is pretty impressive. I think if I'm going to do something in that vein again, I need to do standalones. But they pull off 25, 30 volumes of these incredible stories that capture the imagination of children. I don't know if I have that muscle developed yet.
Oh, I think you're selling yourself short, and people should check out your current children's book, which is now out and available, I Want an Alien for Christmas, and also keep watching the hit series Scorpion on CBS. Nick, again, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and great stuff indeed.
Oh, thank you, Peter, and I always love talking to you, and have a wonderful end of the year.
Nick Santora, author of I Want an Alien for Christmas. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0277, and you'll find links to Amazon.com where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, Your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll touch base once again with Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. They have a new book out called Reality Shock. Plus, Scott Baker, co-author of A Warmer Shade of Blue, talks about the warm-hearted side of police officers. We, of course, have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now. On a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Polk County, Florida sheriff's deputy has been arrested for his actions during a burglary investigation. 28-year-old Ernesto McLeod backed up police in Davenport at a convenience store burglary. In a security camera video, McLeod is seen picking up a DVD from the floor and putting it behind his notepad. From there, he tucked it into his uniform shirt. When investigators noticed the crime, McLeod was charged with petty theft and armed burglary. Armed because he was on duty and he had his duty firearm on his belt. Ernesto McLeod said it best himself, said Sheriff Grady Judd. He threw away a career for a $10 DVD. McLeod told investigators he took the DVD because he hadn't seen the movie. Okay. Investigators have declined to mention what the movie was. But I hope to God this guy didn't throw his entire career away for something like either Battlefield Earth or Ishtar. Please say he didn't. Please. Anyway, I have never understood why people blindly follow their GPS and don't actually look at the road they're on anymore these days. It's so sad. We have more of these stories as time goes on. And just here's the latest case of that. A 50-year-old trucker claims he followed his GPS navigator as he drove across the North Lyon Bridge and one other bridge in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The truck then got stuck along the lakeshore. The problem was both the bridges were pedestrian bridges. There should be no way that this bike route was on that GPS like that, said a witness by the name of Paul Wasser. Incredible when you look at how far he had driven and had to drive over service roads and gravel roads and over a really tight bridge before he apparently stopped. The unnamed driver was cited for reckless driving and failing to obey road signs. The 32,000-pound truck with 53-foot trailers attached to it in the back had to be dismantled and removed with a crane to avoid further damage to the bridges. Wow. Un-freaking-believable. Professional driving, some disassembly required.
Recalculating.
A German woman who identifies herself only as Anaconda, get it? Anaconda, described to Vice Media in October her female fight club in Berlin, which is now 3 years old, for women to test themselves in all-out wrestling matches. Now, while some are fetish-motivated dominance, others display no particular sexuality like Anna herself, who, she admits, simply likes to crush men's and women's skulls between her massive thighs. I actually know some people who would like that, but anyway. Anna says she is a product of East Germany's cliché development of tough, muscular female athletes. Yes. Remember before the Iron Curtain fell, when East German women looked like Dolph Lundgren? Yeah. Memories. Memories. Oh, by the way, isn't the first rule of Fight Club that you don't talk about Fight Club? I believe that's also the second rule of Fight Club. Anaconda is talking too much. Anyway, moving right along. Police in Murfreesboro, North Carolina, announced in November that they had intercepted a shipment of 30 pounds of marijuana that had been loosely packaged and shipped from California by U.S. mail, and an investigation was underway with arrests expected. Police Chief Daryl Rowe said that the scent of the packages was so vivid that even though he had summoned the department's canine unit, the dog kind of looked at us as if to say, "Do you really need me for this?" Wow. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, people go to school to learn, but unfortunately, sometimes the people who run the schools are morons. We have two such examples, and ironically, both of them hail from Alabama. Not that I'm casting aspersions on Alabama. It's just where the stories come from. Story number one. In October, a mother charged that officials at E.R. Dixon School in Mobile, Alabama, first detained her daughter, age 5, for pointing a crayon at another student as if it were a gun, and then pressured the girl to sign a paper promising not to kill anyone or commit suicide. "What is suicide, Mommy?" the girl asked when her parents arrived. Yeah. There's going to be a lot of explaining to be done here, both to the girl and to the parents, I think, in this case, and maybe even an attorney or two. And story number two, in a 2010 incident at Sparkman Middle School near Huntsville, Alabama, an administrator coaxed a 14-year-old special needs girl into the boys' bathroom to bait a 16-year-old boy who had previous sexual misconduct issues into committing a prosecutable offense. And then, this is the part that baffles me, failed to protect the girl. The girl's family sued and won a summary judgment, but the school board appealed, and in September of this year, the U.S. Justice Department finally endorsed the family's lawsuit. Wow. I would have made both of those school administrators in those two stories the idiots of the day, but this is beyond idiocy. This is just really plain sad. Just plain sad. So let's move along, shall we, and get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Like clockwork, you can always expect another entertaining book chock-filled with fun from the folks at Ripley's Believe It or Not. Their latest tome is called Reality Shock. And once again, we welcome back on the program Edward Meyer, the VP of Exhibits and Archives from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Hi, Edward.
Hey, good afternoon.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Well, I always love it when I'm a repeat performer. That means somebody's doing something right.
Good, good. So this latest book, Reality Shock, you also have a lot of things in there that deal with the holidays, which are coming up as well. But it's another book chock full of interesting things. But let's talk a little bit about the holidays.
About 1,000 stories, roughly 500 great photos. It's an oversized coffee table style book. You know, not necessarily meant to be read cover to cover, but one of those things that you put it down and open it up at any page and you're going to find something that's going to amaze you, and you'll end up reading a lot more than you thought you might. You know?
That's a sign of a great book always. Now, some of the holiday things that are in there, now I understand there's a Christmas pudding that costs $38,000. That's got to be some pretty good pudding.
All right. Well, first, this is a story out of London, England. And when they say pudding in England, they really mean dessert. This isn't literally a pudding, as you might think, but it's still a very, very costly piece of dessert. And it's got some very expensive liquor in it, specifically cognac. And it's got some rare Iranian almonds in it. And then it's got a gold coin that's like 500 years old that's worth about almost half of the whole value, sort of thing. So it's a very expensive, one-time-only dessert, most people don't like Christmas pudding anyway, so it's probably going to be around for a few years, but $38,000 made by a chef named Martin Chevers of London, England. For the person who's got everything, I guess.
Also for the person who's got everything, a gingerbread house that can fit five people inside?
You know, full-size house made out of gingerbread, all the trimmings, 60 by 42 feet, 1,800 pounds of butter, 7,200 eggs. And think about that for a little bit, because, you know, even cracking a half a dozen eggs to make your omelet in the morning, you know, takes some time and effort, and I can't fathom breaking 7,200 eggs. 7,200 pounds of flour, almost 3,000 pounds of brown sugar, 22,000 plus pieces of candy, and then if you're sitting down and thinking you're maybe a pound or so overweight, just thinking about it, 36 million calories.
Wow.
That's a Hollywood a holiday feast all in itself.
I'm wondering if a building inspector had to be involved.
Yeah, probably. This is from a little town of Bryan, Texas, and you know, I'm a big fan of gingerbread houses at Christmas, but I don't think we've ever made one bigger than about, you know, a foot by a foot. So I have trouble even visualizing this one.
Mm. Now, people are still at this early stage of the Christmas holidays putting up their Christmas decorations, but at the end of the day, when all is said and done after Christmas, you have to get rid of the Christmas trees. Now, there's...
Well, I've got a personal little story here. The item in the book is page 98, and this is a little town in Germany that actually has annual world champion Christmas tree throwing championships. And they've got three different divisions. One, basically, you're throwing it like a spear, javelin, straight forward. One, you get to swing it around a few times like a hammer throw. And one is how high you can throw it straight up in the air. Now, of course, they've taken all the decorations off first, but it's still kind of amusing to even think about flying Christmas trees. 36 years plus ago, the only year that I ever had a real Christmas tree since I've been married, my wife swore that we'd never have another one, and she's going to win that award for as long as she lives, I think. But we lived on a third-story apartment building, and I looked at the stairs, and I looked at the elevator, and I said, the easiest way to get rid of this Christmas tree is toss it over the balcony. And I, of course, was quite careful and made sure there was nobody below, but I don't think I've ever got in more trouble with a landlord. And then, of course, I got in bigger trouble with my wife, and 36 years later, we've never had a real Christmas tree again. So don't throw your Christmas tree over your balcony. Go to Weidendahl, Germany, and enter the world's Christmas tree throwing contest.
And how you're not in the book, I'll never know.
Well, I am, actually. There's probably a couple things in here real early in the book. Let me just get the... Can't even remember what I did. Okay, we're on page 8 in the book. Shows a nice picture of me in India with the man with the world's longest mustache. And I literally just lucked into this guy. I was in India looking for Believe It or Nots, obviously, but this guy was a lucky find. I was with a translator, tour guide, and he said that there was a man who had been in Ripley's before, and his father had been in Ripley's before, and he thought he was worthy of being in Ripley's. Did I want to meet him? And I said, sure. And so we went and we met this gentleman with the world's longest mustache, 102 inches. And way back in 1933, we got a picture of Robert Ripley measuring his grandfather's mustache. And it turns out his grandfather came to America and was at the very first Ripley Museum way back in 1933.
Wow. Impressive.
And then you don't actually see a picture of me on page 9, but there's a really great story about a tiger hairball that I've got a personal connection with, too. And this was a tiger, and I, you know, maybe TMI here, but I was in the shower, come out of the shower, and I hear the morning news talking about this tiger needing an operation. It was choking to death. And I said, you know, this sounds like something that I need to know about. And we called this person about an hour later, and they said, well, the tiger's got a big hairball, and it's choking to death, and we don't have the money for the surgery here at this, big cat game reserve. And I said, well, Ripley's will put up the money for the operation if we get the hairball. And so we helped save this tiger's life. And his name, very unoriginal, is just Ty the Tiger. And they came up to our offices, roughly about a four-hour drive from where they were in South Florida. And they presented us with this big, ugly hairball from Ty's stomach. And they also brought Ty with them. Now, indeed, still, but got to pet it as a puppy dog and walk him on the leash. And in front of a commercial little place here in Orlando, Florida, that was pretty big news. Everybody running out to see what was going on. And it was a real thrill to make friends with a tiger. Hmm. Now, I put the hairball into a cooler, like a camping cooler, and it smelled pretty bad. And we put it outside the back of our lot in the cooler with the cooler open, hoping to air this thing out a little bit. And we came back an hour later, and somebody had stole our cooler with the hairball. So we didn't own it for very long, but we saw it, we measured it, we photographed it, and it was the biggest hairball I've ever seen. But somebody got a real shock when they opened that cooler and found one of the smelliest things I've ever witnessed.
Wow. And speaking of TMI, we have just have a few more minutes. I got to ask this question. There's the story of the 56-year-old grandmother who can function with 18-inch long nails.
Well, her nails are just a little bit shorter now. Unfortunately, in helping us promote this book, she broke one over in London, England.
Ouch.
And she has cut all of them off, not all the way by any means, but in the book they're pictured as 18 inches, and I think she's taken about 5 inches off all of them, having broke the one she wanted them all to be even. But this is a 56-year-old grandmother out of Houston, Texas. Her name's Ayanna, and, you know, I've met and spent some time with a person that had even longer nails, named Lee Redman, and Lee couldn't do anything by herself. She had people to do every single thing for her and walk down the street with bodyguards so that she didn't bump into anything. And Ayanna is the same way. She cannot wash dishes. Her nails will not fit into a regular sink. So she's convinced her grandchildren. I think it's interesting that her children wouldn't help her, but she's convinced the grandchildren that they've got to do these things for her. And what we've got pictured in the book is they're doing some very basic stuff, combing her hair, talking on a cell phone, but every single thing is a major chore.
I
personally don't understand why anyone would want to do this. I personally don't think it looks very beautiful, but I guess it's, some sort of personal act of beauty. She likes the color purple and likes to paint them and decorate them all in purple and changes them up every week. It's absorbed her life. It's all what she's about.
And this is where the TMI comes in, because every time I see these stories or hear these stories, the first thing that comes to mind, besides the fact that obviously she's not a touch typist, is how does one clean themselves when they go to the bathroom? That's the question that always comes to my mind in these stories.
Well, you are an interesting gentleman if that's the first thing that comes to your mind, but you're not alone. The previous lady, as I mentioned, her name was Lee Redman, and her nails were roughly about the same size, 17, 18 inches long, on the Ellen DeGeneres show. And it was one of the funniest, perfect setups. I can't believe it got past the censors. But they introduced the guest, and Lee was walking out onto the stage, and Ellen was sitting on a toilet, and she had fake nails on, and she was trying to unroll some toilet paper, and it was just hilarious. I mean, it was like the best setup you could imagine, and then she sort of threw it at Lee, and Lee couldn't catch it because of her fingernails and said, "I can't do this. You'll have to do it for me," and the woman actually, it was amazing that she could work a roll of toilet paper with 18-inch fingernails. But on national television, I was really shocked that they showed it.
Well, and speaking of the word shock, that is the title of the latest Ripley's book, and that's where we'll end it. The book is called Reality Shock. Edward, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program, and best of the holiday season to you.
Have I got 3 seconds for another plug?
Sure, very quickly.
PBS, January 6th, The American Experience, a full one-hour biography of Robert Ripley. We're really excited about it.
PBS, January when?
January 6th, prime time on The American Experience.
Excellent. Thank you very much, sir. Take care.
Merry Christmas.
Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Their latest book is Reality Shock. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0277, and you'll find the link to the Ripley's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca where you can order the book directly. And by the way, you can also find links about the PBS edition of The American Experience on January 6th. Now, that features a full one-hour biography on Robert Ripley. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Jonathan Sowerbeer is one busy guy. In addition to being a computer science student, he's written a series of science fiction books, created a video game, and even found time to teach younger students programming skills during the summer. Yet, when he recently wrote a special commentary that was published in the Wall Street Journal, it had nothing to do with computers. Instead, he was mad about a $20 check he got because of a class-action lawsuit against Toyota. He wasn't angry about the small size of the check, though. He was mad that he got the check in the first place, because he's happy with his car and hasn't suffered any injuries. He wondered how the lawyers who sued the company could make over $200 million, about 500 times what the primary plaintiffs who sued the company received. Let's be fair, lots of legal experts have written about America's lawsuit problem, but when a college student who dabbles in science fiction takes time to write about it in the Wall Street Journal, that deserves a second look. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And we'll talk about the warmer side of cops in just a matter of moments. Plus, of course, as you know, we always have an idiot of the day on the program at the end of the show, and we'll get to that a little later on. Stick around for that. But you know what? We'll get right to our next guest right now because we're kind of short on time this week. So we're going to hurry right up and get to our next guest here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Scott Baker is a former NYPD officer who has written several books. We spoke to him several years ago on our old radio show about his book, The Funniest Cop Stories Ever. Since then, he has co-authored A Lighter Shade of Blue, and he has a new one out about the folks behind the badge called A Warmer Shade of Blue. Scott joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me. It's great to see you. Great to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you again as well. And good to see that you're keeping busy writing books about police officers yet again. I actually got a Facebook message from you recently because you thought it was important to bring up your latest book, Warmer Shade of Blue, because of what's going on in the world these days, right?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, people ask me all the time about the funny stories, but there's more important things. It's funny, you know, like the funny stories that happen are humor subjective, so you could tell a story, someone could think like, oh, that's not funny or whatever, but you know, everyone loves a good heartfelt spiritual feel good story. I think that's why Chicken Soup for the Soul has done so well, but in a time like now we really need it. You know, I think there's a total miscommunication between what people perceive between the community and the police.
Now, in writing these books, because as I mentioned, this is not your first book. You've written several books in this kind of vein, and you are a former police officer. So is it becoming easier for you to get people to talk to you because you're a fellow police officer and you have a track record of some of the things you've written about in the past?
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's part that. It's, when I wrote the first book, people, they were mostly my stories and then stories that I have heard. Then when I wrote the second funny book, The Lighter Shade of Blue, those were stories from people who read the first book and sent them to me. So they sent to them, I put it in another book, and it was a big calling for it. But this one was a thing that I wanted to write, and the toughest thing was, believe it or not, this was a tougher sell to get publishers to publish it, because they literally would tell you, listen, if it's not have about corruption or murder, we're really not interested. And I thought that was pretty interesting, you know. So I was like, well, I'm doing it. So I did it, and I ended up, believe it or not, I actually won an award from the International from the International Union of Police Associations. It's an AFL-CIO union. There's 3 million members, and they gave me Book of the Year.
Wow.
And I still couldn't get a publisher to publish it. I had to go publish it myself. Believe it or not, it's crazy.
Well, that brings up another deeper, shall we say, problem. What you were just describing is what the publishers were looking for. Do you worry that what they're saying is a pervasion within the general population or just within the publishers? In other words, are you concerned about the image that some of the people in the general population have about police officers?
I am so glad that you asked me that question, because I tell these people all the time, you know, there's such an image out there that the general public doesn't like the cops, and I think that's a bunch of crap. Oh, sorry if I can't say that on your show, I'm sorry. But I think the general public does like police officers. I think that there's, you know, for the most part, you look, are you always going to get a cop who doesn't know how to talk to the public? Of course. You know, I'm a retired cop. I get pulled over, you know, and, you know, if a cop comes to me, you know, you hope that they're polite and they're, you know, they're professional. But they come to me, and if they talk to me a certain way, I say to myself, geez, you know, I was a cop. I can imagine how you're talking to the public. But that's very, very rare. And then on the other hand, you know, when you see some of the press or some in the media, and again, not all, but, you know, you see some that look for the agitator or look for the person in the public who hates the cop. That's what they want to do, because that's a story. There's friction, so there's a story. But I'm telling you, man, most of the people love to see you. They like to have you in the community, as long as you're professional, of course, you know. But they like to see it in the community. So I don't know if it's the public perception that's bad or if it's the media that's bad, but I do know one definitely fuels the other, because if the media reports on just the bad things, then the public looks at it, you know, understandably, and goes, oh, well, all cops are, or most cops are. And, you know, that's a really dangerous way to perceive. And I think it's detrimental and it's inflammatory, you know, because like I said, most of the people I dealt with, they love to see you on the corner. They love when you show up. They're calling you. They're in trouble, you know.
Absolutely. So give us a couple of examples of some of the things you've written about in your latest book, A Warmer Shade of Blue.
Oh, yeah, sure. One of them, there's a lot of little things. The book covers a lot of tiny things that cops do, such as getting presents for kids that don't have around Christmas time, in a general sense, or making sandwiches for the homeless when the cops have to work on New Year's Eve or Christmas Eve. So they'll go buy cold cuts, or they'll go to a local deli and they'll go, hey, listen, you want to cut up a hero for, you know, we're going to hand it out to the homeless. And, you know, so the cops are going to the deli. The deli's going, sure, no problem. You know, they make a thing, and then the cops take the sandwiches, they put them in little baggies, and they hand them out to homeless people on their post or their beat, you know, their sector. But then, you know, that's general. But specifically, there were some really touching stories, and this one's really pretty amazing. And they're all true, by the way. They're all true stories. Two cops, this happened in Brooklyn, two cops got a call of a family dispute. So they show up at the dispute, and when they get there, you know, it looks like a pretty normal family and whatnot. Everything is kind of, you know, nothing's really out of place, but there's definitely been a fight because you could see the kids are scared and the woman's been crying and the man is distraught. So they're pretty silent when they get in there, and they say, listen, your neighbors called. There was, you know, a whole lot of fighting and yelling and screaming going on. And he goes, you know, what happened? And the guy is sheepish. He's a little sheepish. And he goes, you know, I lost my temper. My wife's yelling at me. I gambled all the rent money away. You know, I lost the rent money, and this isn't the first time. And I think she's lost it, and we're just in a bad spot. So the cops were like, okay, you know what, you know, no one's hurt, you know, no one hit anybody. It's just a lot of yelling and stuff like that. He's like, you know, and the wife chimed in saying, yeah, he's done this before, and I don't know, you know. And they're trying to talk in code because they don't want the kids to hear any more than they've already heard. So the cops, you know, they leave, they calm things down and everything like that, and they end up going to an all-night store, you know, like a bodega, and they grab a whole lot of items. You know, they grab a pizza, they grab some chocolate milk, they grab some cereal, they grab, like, a lot of stuff just to, you know, just to get the family by. And they go back, and they give it to the family, and they talk to the kids, and they each put a smile, you know, lighten the mood, you know.
Right.
So they go, you know, they go on their way. Fast forward about 15 years. Fast forward about 15 to 18 years, somewhere around there. And the cop who went is now a captain. So he's a captain, and he gets a knock on his door. Another cop comes in, and he goes, "Are you Officer, Captain so-and-so?" You know, he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Look, you don't remember me, but about 15, 18 years ago, you stopped by on this call." And he goes, "Yeah, actually, I do remember that. We went out that night." He goes, "Yeah, that was me. I was that little kid." And he goes, "You're kidding me." He goes, "Yeah, I just graduated the police academy, and I just wanted to tell you how much it meant to me, because when you did that, it really made me look at cops differently. And I just wanted to come and salute you." And he snapped off a salute to the captain. Man, you talk about George Bailey, It's a Wonderful Life, where, you know, you don't know how your life affects others. I mean, that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing that this kid had that in his soul for 15 to 18 years, and made him want to become a cop, and remembered it and went and thanked him afterwards. That's just amazing stuff.
How do you get through writing a book like that without crying, by the way?
I'm teary. You know what? I don't want to sound unmacho, but every time I tell the story, it tears me up. Yeah, if you know, it doesn't choke you up, you're not human, you know? It's truly amazing. And to focus on all the bad stuff is criminal, you know? And these are not stories that should be aberrations. These are stories, the aberration should be when the communities don't come together. You know, I've always said, and I don't know why they don't do it, but I've always said that the best way to bridge this gap is to take cops and go into the schools to the youth and tell the kids what their rights are and what they should expect from the police and how they should also behave when pulled over. Now, if there's or stopped, and if there's a break in protocol, here's what you can do. But also understand, when questioning you, it's for a reason. And now if he gets out of line, you have the right to do A, B, and C, whatever the law may state in that particular jurisdiction. But I think that would go a long way to bridging the gap in communication, because a lot of people, you know, they think they have rights they don't have, and a lot of people don't know the rights they do have. So I think that would go a long way, and, you know, along with stories like this. That's why I dropped this book down to 99 cents. I'm not making any profit. I dropped it down on Amazon and all those just to get the word out, you know. You know, because I have to charge something, because they don't let you give it away for free, because otherwise they don't make any money.
Right.
You know. Yeah, I have to.
Well, you mentioned that there should be more stories like this as opposed to the ones that we often hear about. There's a term that's often used, unsung heroes, and I think that's what you're literally describing. And when people say unsung heroes, people are always thinking about heroism and situations where people are in danger. But no, it's the day-to-day unsung stories like that police officer you just described who helped that family, and how it turned out 18 years later. Those are the unsung heroes, are those stories you never hear about. So I'm glad you've put it together in a book.
Yeah, agreed. Thank you, Peter. It's you know, it goes from the, and it runs the gamut from that to a cop in L.A. I think this happened in L.A. in the book. He was just on regular patrol. Not, this isn't going to make you teary-eyed, but this is exactly to prove your point. He's just on patrol, and he sees a kid, a kid of color. You know, his chain fell off his bike. He's trying to fix it. The cop had one of those Leatherman fixer tools on him, and he pulls the patrol car over, and he just gets out, turns the kid's bike over, and he starts talking to the kid and helping him fix it. And a woman walks by, also a woman of color, and says, you know, this is what the media needs to see. And, does it break your heart? No, but that's exactly what you, just to prove your point, it's the unsung heroes. That kid whose bike got fixed is going to remember that cop did it for who knows how long.
Exactly.
You know?
Again, the book is called A Warmer Shade of Blue. It's written by Scott Baker. Scott, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Hey, man, you know, Peter, I have the utmost respect for you. You're the best, and thank you very much for having me.
Scott Baker, co-author of A Warmer Shade of Blue. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0277, and you'll find links to Amazon.com where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police in Portland, Maine, responding to a burglar alarm, found a man had accidentally set off the alarm when trying to visit a friend. 29-year-old Ronald Podlaski, who goes by the street name Rooksai, decided to sneak into his friend's third-story apartment by climbing the fire escape. But he misjudged where that apartment was. He was two buildings away, and ended up in a storage area for a florist. "I realized I was in a place I wasn't supposed to be," he said, but by then he had set off the alarm. As he tried to leave, he fell from the fire escape onto a brick sidewalk, which is where police found him with minor injuries. When officers asked for his name, he could only say, "Rooksai." Yeah, and he was booked into jail under that name, charged with burglary, criminal mischief, and theft. Podlaski was apparently convincing with his visiting a friend story, though. Prosecutors decided not to press charges. "I'm not a bad person. I'm in no way a thief," Podlaski said. "I'm a foolish young man who ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time." Well, a 29-year-old man with apparently no sense of direction who wants to be known by a street name. Well, maybe he should change that street name to Idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0277. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0277. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.